Welcome to episode 25 of How to Stay Sane in an Insane World, the show formerly known as Shed Talks. My name is Jeremy Thomas and I'm going to be your host. If you're new to this, this is a podcast about mental health and well-being. We only interview interesting people. Today, we are extremely fortunate to have a super interesting guest. He has had an amazing career of over 50 years in TV, radio, theatre and film, ranging from films like Superman to the new Avengers on telly, Triangle to Our Friends in the North to a whole career in theatre. He is an amazing linguist, a father of five, someone who's laid electric cables in a tunnel underneath Manhattan, who's worked in the oil industry laying pipes, is a builder of lakes, a writer, a grafter, a survivor, and now a poet. Most recently best known for a two-year stint in EastEnders as super baddie Archie Mitchell, and then the hugely popular father of Gavin and Gavin and Stacey, Mick Shipman. Born in Enfield, North London in October 1947, clearly the youngest looking 78-year-old you have ever had on the show. Please welcome the extraordinary, versatile and wonderful Larry Lamb.
What a build-up. Get your way out of that one.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to come back to your career, hugely long, versatile acting career. But I want to ask you a couple of questions and say to you that was it the sense of family on the set of EastEnders, or similarly in Gavin and Stacey, that attracted you to those parts?
Well, when you play a part of a family on a TV show, particularly when it runs for a while, you do tend to get drawn into the feeling that you are part of a family. I mean, I was in a show that we did back in 1979 called Fox, about a London family, and there were five brothers, and we all for years regarded each other as brothers, you know?
Right.
And so EastEnders, you go into a family, you know, so you better get ready for it. That's what you're there for. And I guess really in that same way, you know, you were to be part of a family in Gavin and Stacey. So it makes it easier. You know, they've put together a family for you. This is your brother, this is your sister, this is your son, your daughter and everything else. And you just kind of get on with it, you know?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't say that you were particularly drawn to the fact that it was a part where you were going to be playing a member of a family, but it kind of enhances the whole deal.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Particularly when it's well cast.
Yes.
And that's the one thing with those two shows. You know, they're really cast to type, to appearance. You're not shocked when you look at any of those characters playing what they're playing. They look right.
Yeah. No. I suppose it was just the family bit. And I mean, you know, as an aside, just on Gavin and Stacey, and this has really got nothing to do with anything except
you being a Welshman and all the rest of it.
Well, that's certainly true. But no, I've been a long-term fan of Alison Steadman.
Yes.
And
yes.
I mean, you know, going back Nuts in May, which I absolutely just can't get enough of.
Yep.
Abigail's Party, Life is Sweet, which to me was the best thing Mike Lee ever did, actually. And I just think she's a very special thing. And I know you have a bit of a soft spot, I think.
She is a really special person, that one, you know. I mean, we'd sort of run into each other through mutual friends years before. We'd actually worked together, but we still can't figure out what it was and when it was. But the thing is with Alison, she's absolutely the opposite of the character she plays in Gavin and Stacey. So she's a very contained, very private person.
All right.
And she's really a joy to be around, you know. So we've kind of, we don't live far apart, but we never really meet up again.
That's one of those
things. We just sort of like, we're mates, we work together, we had a wonderful time doing that, and then now and again you find yourself in the same room together and you just get on with it, you know, just old buddies. It's wonderful. She's really special.
I think so. And also the other thing that I thought was fun about that show was a bit of sort of ground glass, which was Pete and Dawn.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, Pete and Dawn.
Adrian Scarborough and
Julia Davis.
Yes.
Yeah. And what really, really cheered me up, because they were always these, as you put it, a bit of ground glass in there, just to upset things and just to show that it wasn't all sweetness and light everywhere in that neighbourhood. Was the way they really came to the fore in the grand finale, and they let you see what they're really all about. This couple who adore each other, but they're prepared to go for the jugular. You know,
yeah,
it was fantastic.
No, it really was.
They really got their day.
I mean, Julia Davis, I think, is a pretty good writer, put it mildly. And, you know, she obviously went, right, Adrian.
Yeah, that's it.
I wanted to mention that because it was interesting to me. So I've been lucky to read your autobiography, which is titled Mummy's Boy. I think it was an ironic title.
Not really.
No?
The title Mummy's Boy is what it is all about, because I was a mummy's boy who was forced to live without his mum, was mothered extraordinarily by my gran, my dad's mum, and the women in my life have been, you know, this ongoing line of women who have basically taken me under their wing.
The point I would make to you is that... knowing you as I do, and the autobiography, the one thing you're not in so many ways is a mummy's boy. You're a tough geezer who's done a lot, and we're going to talk about it. You know, going all over the world and working, and you're a tough guy. You're not. There are two ways.
I'm not as tough. I look tougher than I am, to be perfectly honest with you.
Okay. But a mummy's boy has another...
Yeah, another connotation.
Anyway, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying...
No, I'm you know, to me, that's... It's what I realised I was as I wrote the autobiography, dependent upon these women in my life.
All right. Well, look, let's go back. Your dad, Ron, your mum, Jessie... Tell me about Jessie. What was she like?
Jessie was her. She'd been adopted. She was adopted as about a two year old. I was sort of made a part of the whole "Who Do You Think You Are" program, and we found out all about my mum's background because she was adopted by the people who I always knew as my nan and granddad. And my mother had been put into foster care. There was a professional foster lady, and the my mother's actual birth mother could not afford to keep up with the 11 shillings a week she was having to pay the foster mother.
Right.
And she said to the foster mother, "Do you know anybody that might be interested in taking on my daughter?" And she said, "I have a sister and her husband. They want to have children, but they can't." And so that's who finished up being my grandparents. And my mother was, you know, raised by these very, very old-fashioned, respectable, educated, working-class people, members of the Woodcraft folk, the London Cooperative. So my mum was put through, you know, she went to grammar school and was well-educated. The war came up and she went off, like a lot of girls, teenage girls, went off, joined the Land Army and finished up in Norfolk. And then she went to a party on New Year's Eve. Shall I tell you a little poem which explains my entire creation?
Yes, please.
Somebody must have been to blame for giving the party where mum and dad met. clearly Dad's neighbour, Georgie Clark, it was his fault they went and made love in the park at the end of their road, but only for fun. This, though, was serious. Teenagers both, as the war had started, they'd learned from the movies about love and marriage, but this flash of passion was nothing but that. No princess, no prince, no golden carriage. A story not destined for a happy future. In the upper floor of a parent's home, forced into marriage, going nowhere, like two caged beasts with their newborn son, not planning a future, just desperate to run, both of them. All they shared was hatred and me, a boomer. I was certainly born with a bang.
Blimey.
That's them. That's what it was. That's what I was born into, a war zone. They hated each other and spent 9 years living together, during the course of which my brother was born a year later, and then my baby sister was born 9 years later.
Right.
So living in a war zone, that started my life out.
But what we didn't do there, which I want to do, is what was your mum like?
What my mum was like was just a... She was kind of funny, light-hearted, you know, always wanted to have a laugh. She loved to dance. And, you know, she just picked a wrong one with my dad. I mean, my dad had his good points, but he was totally messed up by the Second World War. Like so many of those boys, he went off and they thought they were going to be heroes, you know. And we were standing when I was, you know, an adult, we were having a discussion about it. And he said he just realized he wasn't far from a hero. He was terrified of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so she met him at a party. They finish up down the park. And, you know, 9 months later, I'm born, and she's got a baby boy. And then within 14 months, she's got another baby boy. And right. They're trying to have a life. And the only way they dealt with it was when it really went bad, they would move somewhere else.
Right, right.
It was just a disaster.
Yeah.
He volunteered himself in to get, you know, electric shock therapy when they were about to the point where they would break up.
Right.
So he was a depressive, for sure.
He knew that.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I'm just taking it from the book. It sounded like he was quite a possessive person and,
yeah,
you know, always suspicious of her.
And yeah, always, always suspicious and accusing her all the time in front of me.
Yeah, yeah. And in the end, you know, that boiled up, when you were 9 or 10?
9, yeah.
And yeah. That was like, she's going, I've had enough.
Yeah, and she did. We were living in a house next door to the fish shop that they ran.
Right.
And next door to that, they were building a pub. And there was a guy working on the site that realised my mum was having a hard time, and they became involved with each other, and in the end, they ran off together.
Right.
And, you know, my brother and my brother and I went and lived with my grandmother, and my baby sister went with my mum.
Yeah, which is a big deal.
It was a big deal, yeah.
And your father was very much, you're not to see your mother and all that.
Yeah, well, we used to see my mother at the bus stop every other Saturday. Oh. So she would come on the bus and bring my baby sister, and we would, I don't know, we would walk down the park or, you know, go to a cafe and have an ice cream or something, you know, whatever we did. But she came, I think, every other weekend, and so we saw her. That was it in terms of visitation or whatever.
Which must have been kind of traumatic, really.
Very traumatic. The whole thing was an embarrassment. This is something that people lose sight of, I think. You know, for a child, what these two people, your world is torn in two, and they're just behaving so badly. It's embarrassing because somewhere inside you, you've got this instinct for how it should be.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just upsetting the whole apple cart, right? And they're just not behaving the right way. So on top of it all, I remember I would think, you know, this whole thing of waiting for the bus to come. And because you didn't know when she would be coming, you just knew she'd be coming about, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd fix that, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And there you would wait by the bus stop and you'd wait. But you were not allowed to know where she came from, had no idea where she lived, because to talk about the fact she was with somebody else was absolutely taboo.
Just moving the story on a tiny bit, you know, you won a place at Edmonton County School, right?
Yeah.
Grammar school, very good school. You started to learn German, which I thought was quite...
French first.
Oh, French first, and
yeah.
Then German.
French
okay.
first.
Okay.
The one that really set me off in French was a woman called Miss Pagan. And Miss Pagan was this angelic-looking character, and she made me fall in love with the French language because she really taught you... And this is just in the first year, because back in those days, in that school, the women... If they were going to get married, they had to leave. They weren't allowed to stay there. It was
really?
That old
God,
regime.
Amazing.
So Miss Pagan had instilled this love of French in me because she taught us songs. She taught us poems. And this is what I really needed to do to get a hold of something from another world, because all I knew of France was that my great uncle and my grandfather had served there in the First World War.
Yeah.
That was it. France, that's it, done. And so this woman started to make me understand that there was this world just across this channel where they didn't speak the way you did.
So one of the things I've noticed about your story, which I think is really interesting, is that when you were, you know, teenager, you took, you know, part-time jobs. You know, you had Saturday jobs, fish shop job, this job, that. And there was a really great Albert Hunt. I mean, such Albert. A brilliant...
God, what a character. What a character.
Tell us about it. Tell
what
us about
a character. It. Harlow, Newtown, had a town square, and on a Tuesday, and I think Tuesday and a Friday and a Saturday, they had a market there.
Yeah.
So there was this one big stall there, fruit and vegetable stall, and I knew a guy that worked, and it was funny, I knew a guy that worked there, and he told me he was leaving his job. He had a job there. And I walked to the stall, and Albert Hunt was there. You know, it was a Saturday, I think. There he was, and he was always really absolutely immaculately dressed. As he was a horseman, really,
right.
Like a gypsy horseman. He bought and sold horses,
right.
All different sorts of horses.
Yeah.
And he dressed like a horseman. He always wore little sort of like cut off riding boots, like Chelsea boots, but always brilliantly shone. He always had a waistcoat. And trousers like trousers that were trimmed, which you didn't wear then, with little turn ups on them, and then a jacket over the top. But he always wore like a brown trilby, and he always wore like a scarf tied around his neck, and they called it a shtuck. That's what it was, and he was he was a tough guy. He was from the East End, and he. He had a couple of trucks, and he was, you know, like very full on in terms of selling.
Yeah.
And so when you're
you're
selling fruit and vegetables, I walked up to him and said, "Is there any chance you're looking for somebody? I've heard so and so was not working here anymore." Yeah. He said, "Can you shout?" I said, "Christ in my house, mate! If you can't shout, you're finished." So he said, "Right, let's get to work on them bananas, right?" Good lot of bananas. Come on, girls. That's the way to buy and bake, boil a fry, make a pudding, make a pie. You make your mummy love you, daddy. And so I began to become an entertainer on the market in
Brilliant.
Harlow. My first ever public performance was there.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
And that's it. And Albert Hunt taught you how to do it.
But, I mean, it must have given you a real sense of self-esteem.
Absolutely.
You know? Hello, I'm
absolutely. Jack the Lad, right?
I'm Jack the Lad and got people coming to see me.
And you got money.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't any pocket money lying around, right?
No. But that's my point, Larry, that it strikes me, you know, because we go in a big circle of mental health here. And you know, one of the big problems with mental health, or one of the problems is poor self-esteem, where people don't have any opinion about themselves. You know, they think they're useless. And, you know, you obviously went out and did this, and it must have bridged some gap, you know, where
well,
made you feel better.
Well, the thing is, what I realise now is that self-esteem was what... That's what I was desperate for. I had a... I was really lucky with my nan and my uncle that lived at my nan's, my Uncle Terry.
Yeah.
Because what I've realised now after, you know, a lifetime out there is that your world as a working class boy at that time is a very, very small world.
Yeah.
And somehow or other I knew it was a small world. And I knew that I had to have a bigger world than that. And so, like, you go and work on a market stall, You're dealing with the public, that full on. Not only are you dealing with, you're not just across a counter, you're shouting out to attract a crowd.
No, I get it.
And so, as you say, it gave me a sense of esteem
and confidence.
Where there really wasn't anything else that was doing. It certainly wasn't coming from school. I was hopeless at all the sports, and I was at a school where you had to have a go at doing everything.
Right.
And I was hopeless at all of them.
But you weren't at languages.
No, it was the only thing I could do was speak French.
Yeah.
That's it.
And if I can be a bit cheeky here and say that, you know, we had another incident a little bit further on when you met this girl called Anita.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she became pregnant and wanted to have the baby. And, oh, my God.
Well, you know, that was it. And it's sort of this, especially now as a dad, I've got four children.
Right.
And, you know, my kids and I have a really, really extraordinary relationship. But what happened there was she and I got married, Anita and I got married. And it was, and I just basically didn't want to know.
Couldn't handle it.
I did not want to know. It's terrible. I mean, I look back now and think, you know, the lives you live throughout your life, the people you are at different stages. You know, I was just this feckless lad who'd got a girl in trouble and then we got married and then the baby was born and I only ever saw that baby once when she was 7 months old.
Right.
And it's just one of those things. I always think she's born right around the same time as me.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things that is a huge regret in my life.
Yeah, yeah. No, sure.
Being a loving father and wanting to know everything about your kids. And they're about 45 years old and, you know, like in their 20s and thinking that there's a woman there that I was the father of and have never had anything to do with.
Yeah. But hopefully it all worked out for her and it was the other final springboard for you to get cracking and leave the country and get working.
Well, I just knew I had to get out into the world. I mean, I remember I wanted to travel. I wanted to get out into that world. I think learning French had made me just start to look across the channel. And I think it was sort of when we were about 15 or 16, approaching doing the O levels or, you know, GCSEs, the council sent somebody round to do a talk about careers. So anyway, you know, hall full of like 15-year-olds with some official up there giving us a chat with bits up on a board and all the rest of it. And so there came the point, are there any questions? And of course, total silence. And in the end, I thought, this is too much. I've got a chance to ask somebody. Yeah. So I put my hand up and they said, stand up. And so I stood up in the midst of this sea of faces, you know, and I said, how do you become an oil driller? Because I'd seen stuff on the, you know, this was like an adventurous job out in the jungle, out in some place in the desert or whatever. And so this brought the house down. Everybody was just laughing. They thought but he gave me a couple of clues. I wrote a few letters, tried to find out about it. It was a waste of time anyway because I wouldn't have any qualifications. You needed qualifications. So I found out that. And just purely by chance, one thing led to another. And a finish up must have been like 70, when I was 25. So 10 years later, finished up in Libya working on oil rigs for Esso out in the desert.
Oh, and was that after Germany, working in Germany?
Yeah.
On the American air bases?
I came back from Germany. They were building this massive grid to carry the natural gas throughout the UK, and they needed people to train as technicians working on it, installing temporary anti-corrosion systems. So I got a job on that. That led to me going to Libya, and By then, I married the lady who became my second wife, a glorious American woman called Jackie Paris, God bless her. And I'd met, after the wedding in America, I'd met one of her cousins. It turned out one of her cousins had a brother who worked in exactly this same area of the oil business. I finished up getting a job and emigrating to America.
Unbelievable.
I know.
Unbelievable.
I mean, literally, this way that it went, flip, 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 flip.
I know. Well, it is unbelievable.
Kick the bushes, see what's in there. If it's any good, grab it, and if not, move on.
But can I just say that amidst this, you had actually joined a couple of amateur dramatic societies.
And yeah.
If I'm not wrong, I may, because I get a lot of things wrong, that there was one point, and I'm not sure whether it was in Germany, but where A Man for All Seasons was being put on, and
basically what happened is this American woman I met at a party, and you know, I was desperately trying to have my evil way with her. She was having none of it. She was much, much too bright, much older than me, and was madly in love with somebody else. So she was having none of it. But one thing she said to me, you know, Larry, you should be an actor. And she took me along to a drama group, and she introduced me to the whole world of amateur theatre. And that gradually became, you know, that became my hobby. And the guy said to me, look, we've got a problem with this play we're going to do. It's called A Man for All Seasons. And our local star is very upset because I'm not casting him in the central character, which is Sir Thomas More. And I've offered him the part of Henry VIII. Do you think you could play it? Well, what I didn't tell him is that I'd seen the film of it where Robert Shaw played Henry VIII.
Absolutely.
And I'd got that image in my mind. And so I said, well, I could do that. So I basically gave him my version of Robert Shaw, giving his version of Henry VIII.
Yeah.
And suddenly I was on stage acting, which was a lot different to being on stage or on stage rehearsing. And I was so nervous. I was, you know, really good in the audition, really good in the rehearsals, but got me in front of a crowd, and that took me more than 40 years to get over that.
Really?
Yeah.
So then we basically get you in America. You go back to America.
Well, I went to America then, because what happened was we got married. She and I was working in Libya at that time. She's back in America, then we would meet up back in England, and I was back and forth all the time. And then I got the offer of the job, went and you know, emigrated into America and got a job working there.
And you were working in New York?
Worked in New York a lot, because this was a company based on the outskirts of Philadelphia.
Right.
And so we had a big contract for the big, what's called Con Edison,
who
did all the power in New York, all the gas and electrics and everything else. So this guy and I were working together, and we figured, right, let's get out. Like, as soon as it's, you know, can go and work, 5 o'clock in the morning, we would be on the street running a survey on a pipeline that ran right under Manhattan.
Brilliant.
And one morning, I'll never forget this because of the relevance of it. We're out on the street, and he's across one side of the road, and I'm across on the other side of the road, and he's pointing up to the green street sign, and he calls across, "Hey, buddy, we're on Broadway." And 4 years later, I was in a play at the Music Box Theatre on Broadway.
Amazing.
I know.
Amazing.
I know. In 4 years.
Let's just stay in this lane of the theatre and acting. When did Nova Scotia and Ontario and, you know, Stratford?
Right.
Stratford, Canada happen?
So the people I was working for realised I had some value other than just doing the job. And they'd started a job in Nova Scotia in Eastern Canada. They right. bid on a job to rebuild the power line system for a half of the province.
Right.
And the bloke who was running it had realised it was a nightmare of a job that they were never going to be able to make any money of, and he legged it.
Right.
So within the company, the word went out, we want somebody to go and take care of this thing in Nova Scotia, and I got the gig.
Right.
So I was 26. I was 26 when I got it. It was 1973. Sent me up to Nova Scotia. Great responsibility, huge job, big money, all, you know, expenses, right. great big flash car, everything.
Like it.
All the things I'd ever wanted for. I had them, right? And so I got back into doing amateur theatre because like I knew where I was going to be every night. I wasn't like roving around all over the place,
right.
being sent out week by week on different jobs. I had a base because somebody said to me, you know, they're doing auditions for the local rep company in Halifax in the capital. And so I did an audition and, you know, cut to the chase. I got a job. I became an actor. I was a professional actor. And so that was in 1974-5. And went to the, you know, the guy that auditioned me in Halifax was running the festival in the Shakespeare Festival in Stratford, Ontario.
Yeah.
And there I went, and that was a kind of another key point.
Well, that's
there.
A big deal,
a huge deal.
If you don't know about acting, that is a big deal.
Yeah, and that's where I ran into the people who began the new part of my life, which was, you know, basically. Maggie Smith was the lead in the company. She had Jeremy Brett there with her, Keith Baxter there with her, Hume Cronin, Jessica Tandy. And then, you know, Jeremy Brett said to me, you know, my agent in New York is asking if I could play a Northern Irish docker. And he said, I can't do that, but I know somebody that can. So I finished up going to New York and doing an audition to play George McBrain in Comedians. They needed somebody who could do a Northern Irish accent. They couldn't find one. So I got the gig.
Excellent.
And so then I'm on Broadway.
Bloody hell. Right. So right. We're joining all the dots.
We're
now.
Joining the dots. And then at the end of the job, you know, Jeremy Brett was talking to his agent. He said he should go back to England. He'll work in England. But I remember dropping a name. I'd asked John Lithgow, who was in the play.
Wow.
I'd said, you know, I can do American accents, but I need somebody to kind of work on it with me. And he sent me along to this sort of like Professor Henry Higgins sort of character who worked at Columbia called Robert Neff Williams. This grand old gentleman, really lovely, all in literally in tweeds and, you know, brown Oxfords. And he sort of said to me, you know, it's very interesting, these accents you do. He said, but what we need to do is we need to teach you a basic American accent, literally from the way you pronounce the letters of the alphabet. And that's what we did. He was like Henry Higgins teaching
right,
me.
Yeah.
And so I was learning how to do things with an American accent. And in the end, Jeremy and his agent said, you should go to England. So I literally walked to a travel agent, bought a ticket, and the next day I was on a plane and flew to England. I already had an agent because they'd fixed me up from New York, and I started work. And probably in the next three or four really important jobs, I was playing Americans.
Gosh.
They went straight back and was straight into Superman.
I was just going to say, yeah, I wonder whether we could touch on that.
Yeah, there was. They were doing Superman 1 and 2 together. And you were supposed to be American or Canadian,
yeah.
But they got me in to speak to the casting agent, and she said, right, well, convince me you're an American. So I did. I convinced her I was an American. She said, right, you can do it. So I got a part in that. So literally, I don't know, a couple of weeks after I'd arrived, I was working, and I never really stopped.
But I thought it was quite poignant, you know, to touch on Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, lovely, but lovely man.
Christopher Reeve, for those who don't know, played Superman and was a very good actor. I think it was a horse riding accident.
It was. Yeah, he's on the jumps and he went over the jumps.
He broke his neck, I think.
Busted everything.
And then was quadriplegic.
For several years.
Yeah, and a very brave guy.
Very brave guy.
But you knew him.
I was involved with a health club. Holmes Place Health Club back there in on the Fulham Road,
yeah.
And he was a member there, And so I kind of got to not buddy buddy or whatever. I got to know him, and then I did a voiceover thing for a commercial, doing different accents, and I finished up the combination of the two things. I finished up getting a part in Superman 3. And so suddenly I thought, oh, here we go, I'm in the movies. But it never took off for me. I wasn't good enough.
A different world anyway.
Different. I wasn't good enough. All right, I could get away with it in television. I could get away with it in the theatre. But, you know, when you're working in front of a camera in the movie world, that camera's going right down into your soul.
Yeah.
Right inside. You can't kid the camera.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sure. I couldn't kid the camera.
Well, but you had a fantastic time and career in the other two areas.
Yeah.
Theatre and thing. What I need to touch on here, which is quite important, is Jackie and what happened, and then what happened, and then what happened.
To Jackie Paris?
Yeah.
Jackie Paris was a nurse, and she worked in maternal child welfare. And I was working on an army base in Nuremberg, in the town of Fürth. There was a bunch of Brits there, all working as salesmen. I was working as trying to sell cars then, which is a joke because I still don't know one end of a car from the other, right? And I'm supposed to, and the Americans, they want to know about everything. One Saturday afternoon, this young lady, this nurse, she was in uniform, came in, and she needed some change to put in a parking meter. And so there were three boys, three blokes there, three of us. And we all started sort of like ruffling around, finding some change for her. And then a conversation set up. And so in the end, it turned out there was a party going on that night. And, back in those days, whenever anybody said it was a nurse's party, it was like, whee! And so off we went. All three of us went to there. And I finished up living with Jackie for, we lived together for a year, and then we got married, and it just didn't work out.
Right, right.
Lovely, lovely, lovely lady.
Yeah. It strikes me that you have a great ability to make friends with people. And, looking at all your places that you went to work, there was always a couple who befriended you befriended them. And I hope not being too cheeky here, but you always manage to land the girl as well. And I suppose
not always, most of the time, but not always.
Yeah. But I mean, there were.
But I was desperate to be in love. I was desperate to find this person who was going to take me over.
I think that's what I want to talk about. Really, that sort of some where you're going. I've been with so and so for so long, and. Oh, no, they want to have a kid. I don't want to have a kid. Or, yes, here's so-and-so, and they do want to have a kid. I don't, or whatever it was. But suddenly you jettisoned the relationship, as it were.
Yeah.
And I think that, I'm trying to say, Larry, is that what I think would be really brilliant, if you wouldn't mind, is just to talk about that. And because I think, in a way, there are people listening to this who go, well, actually, I had that sort of a childhood.
Well, at the base of it, I was desperate to be in love.
Right.
Absolutely desperate. That's what I was looking for, was to be in love. It was this, like my father and my mother, they, as in that poem, they'd learn from the movies about love and marriage, right? That's what it was. That's what I was looking for, this perfect thing. I'd been through hell with my parents, who were obviously shouldn't have been together, and I was determined to get it right. So everywhere, I wasn't just looking for a girlfriend. I wanted to be madly in love with somebody.
Was that, sorry to interrupt, was that because you wanted the feeling of that?
Yeah, because right. That's all I understood, was that it was that feeling. That's right. What I was looking for.
Right.
All the rest of it, I wasn't ready for that at all, totally immature.
Right.
There was this thing of, of pursuing women, wanting this perfect relationship with this perfect woman. I wanted to put it all right when it had all been so wrong.
Right. Okay.
That's what it was all about. And so everywhere I went, I was always on the lookout for the perfect woman that I could fall in love with. And it was like, bing. And so what was going on? Jackie Paris and I got married and we were living in America. But straight away, my job meant Sunday night or 4 o'clock Monday morning, I was in the car. I was gone, and I'd be gone until driving home Friday night. You're 5 days out on the road every week. That was the job. You got your weekend off, but you work the 5 days away. Well, that 5 days away was just constant temptation.
Right.
Because you'd go in, you know, like we'd all the guys, you stayed in hotels. And invariably there'd be a bar there, and invariably there'd be music. And so, like what we would now call a sort of a disco bar, that sort of thing, every night of the week, and you were living in them.
Right.
Well, you know, too much temptation, and that literally was what happened between Jackie and I. I just couldn't deal with the temptation, and I didn't want to live a lie.
Yeah, yeah.
And I told her what was going on. I said, I cannot sustain this. I can't do this. I'm just too tempted, and it was sad. We both wept.
I mean, do you think you were in love with love?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like a drug.
Right, right. That's interesting.
That's what you wanted, you know. Yeah. I've got to be in love.
Yeah. And so you basically, you know, as I say, you never seem to have difficulty in attracting people.
Well, you just played the field.
Yeah.
I would go to this bar every night, you know, because I was making loads of money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you sit on the corner, they, you know, keep a stool at the corner of the bar for you. And the guys, you tip these guys probably as much as they were earning. And so I had my spot where I sat and scoped out what was going on there every night. And I'd be in there, you know, 2-3 nights a week, definitely at the weekend in there. And just see what, you know, and this was a big central hotel in Halifax where business people stayed coming from all over Canada. Yeah. And so there was live music downstairs in this bar called the Eager Beaver, right? And you'd go to the Eager Beaver and just play the field.
Yeah, no, I can.
Night after night.
I can see that. I can see it. When did you become aware that there was, bloody hell, I keep doing this, you know, the falling in love bit.
A long, long, long time down the road.
Right, okay.
It was just, you know, it was what I was. It's what I'd become. I'd become this person who was
Lothario.
Always, yeah.
Yeah. But you must have reached a point where you went, enough's enough. I've got to do something about this.
Yeah, I think when I met Linda, my son George's mum, and I'd been back in England for probably 6 or 8 months, and I met her and fell madly in love, and I thought, this is it. This is the woman of my dreams. And we, you know, I think about, we met probably in October, and by January the 13th we were married, and just before Christmas, the 20th of December, George was born.
Right.
And it was all that, you know, it was like that was it. It was, and suddenly I'm the father of a boy.
Yeah.
And we managed to hold it together for about 3 years, but she's very middle class, and I was, you know, very working class, and, you know, it was, she's from an old established Scots family up on the East Coast by Dundee up there.
All right.
I kind of always relate to it as this point where, you know, 3 years of discovering this, living with a middle-class woman, you know, she said, You know, she found the milk bottle on the table again. And she said, Larry, you don't put the milk bottle on the table. So what do I do? Well, you put the milk in a jug and the jug goes in the refrigerator and you bring the jug of milk out to pour in the tea. And I thought, I can't go on. I can't do this. It's too much. And, you know, sadly, reluctantly, we just finished up living apart with George in between us and back and forth between us. And we lived around the corner to each other and we raised our boy between us, even though we didn't live under the same roof. We lived under a flag of truce. If we had a row, we had a row on the phone.
Right. Right.
And, you know, but he didn't actually go through the bust up of a home, you know, as I had.
But she helped you a bit, didn't she?
She was in the sense of, she still is, you know. Yeah. She's the one who, she realised that there was a danger I could screw things up with my son.
Yeah.
In the same way that my father had screwed things up with me, dominating. My father had been taught how to raise a boy by domination, which is the way he'd been raised.
Yeah.
And so that's what he did with me, and that's what I had started to do with George. And I remember we weren't even together, Linda and I, anymore. We were driving into Richmond Park, and George was probably about three and a half or so, like a really boisterous toddler in the back seat of the car, doing a number, you know.
Yeah.
And I pulled into this car, pulled out, jumped out, grabbed hold of him. And it must have been because there certainly were no car seats or anything like that. Grabbed hold of him, right, and swinging him round on the end of my arm. And she just stopped me. She said, Larry, if you want the same relationship as you had with your father, you're going about it the right way. And I don't think you do.
Right.
And literally this bell went off in my head. And I just stopped dead. That was it. And I never, ever, ever pulled any of that stuff ever again. And, you know, fortunately, because as I say, you know, she could have buried me alive.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And completely wrecked
strong.
The opportunity. And we weren't even together.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, she's a magnificent human being.
Yeah.
As is our son.
Yeah, George. Yeah, I get it. So in the book, you talk about a Mr. P.
Oh, yeah, two Mr. P's.
Mr. P in Hampstead and Mr. P in Kensington.
Mr. P from Kensington and Mr. P from Freudville over there. Mr. P from Hampstead.
Can I get you to talk about that? Because I think that's very helpful.
Yeah, well, this guy who was a psychiatrist who was of the Jungian persuasion, right? I didn't understand about what that would have meant at all, right? Mm. And he was very good at making people understand their limitations and the limitations of drink. And I was always a drinker. I wasn't a crazy, crazy drinker, but I drank too much and I couldn't really. I was always allergic to
a binge drinker.
Yeah. A what?
A binge drinker.
Yeah. Not really. I would just drink too much.
Okay.
And that wasn't what a binge drinker would consider. They spilt that much, you know, so I just wasn't good at it.
Right.
But I drank too much of it.
Yeah.
And so she said, it might be an idea for you to go and see him. So I did. I started to go and see Mr. Panzer, every week, once a week, I'd get him a bike and ride round there. And he became this kind of, this magical uncle in my life. And he made me understand how alcohol affected me and how it affected what I was doing as an actor and how I would lose any sense of being in charge when I was acting. Even with a drop of it in me. So it wasn't just if I'd had it in me beforehand.
Yeah.
It was in me all the time. And it affected my libido, you know, and I'd lose my bottle on the stage. I'd lose my bottle in front of a camera. And he got me to the point, you know, I'm pretty good. If you know, I remember when I used to smoke as a kid, and I realised when I was coughing my lungs up, they had to stop, and I stopped.
Yes.
Just stopped dead. That was it. And so what I started to do was, the minute I knew I had a job coming up, and what it was in the, on, you know, in the theatre and on telly, I would stop drinking and adhere to it religiously, not touch a drop.
Interesting.
And that might go on for a year, right?
Yeah.
But I always went back and had a drink once I'd started, you know, once the job was over.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean,
and of course, what happens then? Like, if you've been off it for months and months and months, and you begin to realize that there's another life there,
yeah,
without
another
it.
World, yeah.
And then you have a drink because it's that old world, and you like, oh, yeah, taste of a cold beer, right? Bam! I would have a cold beer in the dressing room waiting for me when I got off stage after the last night, and I drink it, and of course, you'd get the worst hangovers because you've been off it for so long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You'd revisit that whole world. And that went on until I was in my early 60s. So, like, this went on for about this regular routine of stopping went on for about 15 years.
Right.
And some of them extended periods, because I was really, really strict. It would never do, I wouldn't stray,
yeah,
at all.
Yeah.
And then, wallop, I'd be back in there again. And I got to, I must have, early 60s, and I got this hangover, and it went on for 9 days.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, I'm not doing this.
Right.
And that was it. I stopped drinking.
Yeah.
I never touched it ever again.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. Bloody hell. I mean, I think a lot of people can drink for different reasons. You know, they can drink because they're, you know, feared up deep down. They don't have enough confidence.
It was never that for me.
It was never that for
me. No, there was never of that Dutch courage routine,
yeah,
at all for me. I realised, you know, it was, I enjoyed it. I liked it, that bit when you were drunk, but it was the next bit, because I'd always have another glass of it, and then I'd be, you know, I'd be out in the car park throwing up. I'd be, you know, head, arms clutched around the lavatory.
Right, yeah.
You know, so often I'd be like laying out in a car park, absolutely with my head spinning and thinking, oh dear, I'm just the worst feeling. But yeah, I would do it. And as I say, compared with like real drinkers, like they left me miles behind. But it hit me so hard.
Oh, but you know, the great thing is that you solved the problem,
yeah,
and you solved it in an unusual way. I mean, a lot of people that I know go to, you know, AA 12-step programs and things like that, and do it that way. But it shows you that there are various ways in which, yeah, you can solve it. But what you have to do is you have to confront it and be prepared to go voomph,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly. Or be fortunate enough to be able to do that,
yeah,
you know.
So that's that, Mr. P. Now, the second Mr. P is very interesting.
Second Mr. Yes. P. Yes, he was of the Freudian persuasion.
He wasn't the Scottish one, was he?
Yes, he was. Ah. And Mr. Pollock, his name was Mr. P. And so I phoned this man up, and he was a Scotsman. And so I turned up at his room. And I sat down in this reception place, but just about the time I was due to speak to him, I could see this pair of legs coming down the stairs through in the hallway, and down came this man, very well dressed, very neatly, casually dressed.
Right.
He was. I found out he was a lot older than I thought. You know, he was well into his 70s then.
Right.
And so I put my hand out to shake hands with him, and it was like something he didn't really want to do, you know,
yeah,
what I mean? It was like, oh, okay. So we had this attempt at a handshake, and I followed him up the stairs and into his room, and he introduced me to, you know, that world where, you know, you got 40 minutes and,
yeah,
the clock's there. So tell me, what do you want to do? What, you know, what are you here for? So, of course, you know, you're an actor. Somebody's charging you so much money for 50 minutes out of an hour. Whoomph! That
you
was
gave
it.
Gave it loads.
He was just batting it off, you know. But once again, this whole thing of psychiatrists having a real, as I found out later, where they get people who go in there and they can't speak.
Yeah.
And they sit there for half an hour not saying anything. Yeah. Whereas I just, you know, I got 2 hours worth for 1 hour. And so he said, right, at the end of it, what's next? I said, well, I really want to work on this. And as I walked away, I thought, well, he said, well, look, he said, you've just... be back here for the same this same hour session, same day next week, you know, whatever it was, Thursday. So we went along, same thing happened, down came the trousers, down the thing, half-hearted handshake, follow him up the stairs, sit down. We started to talk, and it dawned on me, just as we got into the conversation there on this second visit, this is exactly what I need. No flim-flam. No nonsense. This is somebody, you know, who I can look at and respect and really know they are getting deep into my soul, you know. And that's what I wanted. I wanted somebody who would understand me and not take any bullshit at all. Fabulous. Fabulous. And so I went to see him every working day for the next 3 months.
Simon, right. Great. So it must be... It
was incredible.
You must have felt you were, you'd found it. And
I did, you know, and so we went deep into everything. And I, but particularly into the whole thing of my relationship with my father.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just made me understand why things were the way things were with my father, between my father and me, you know. He lifted the lid off, really, you know. He made me understand this hopeless relationship I had with him, because my father had bullied and dominated me until finally, age 17, I just confronted him because I was sick of it.
I mean, you did have a confrontation later.
Oh, I did, yeah. I did have a big...
Was that before the... psychiatrist?
Yes, it was, because I remember talking about that with old Mr. P from Hampstead.
Yeah.
We had a talk about this showdown I had with my father.
Yeah.
Because it was crucial in my whole relationship with him. And what had happened, I was doing a job, and I was working. I was doing our friends in the north is what was going
you
on.
In
that's when I was
right?
going. I beg your pardon?
Teddington.
I was I was living in Teddington. I was doing our friends in the north, and my then partner was away, and it was a bank holiday, and I got my father there with me, and it was a Sunday, and it was really warm, sunny day. And he started to go on at me about something or other, and it was about George and George's mum, Linda, and, you know, and we got into an argument, he and I, you know, and I said to him, look, don't you start laying down the law to me, because I've got like, I think it was like 49, I was about 49 there, you know, I got 49 years inside me all working, and you just need to... like button it, and he wouldn't, and it just went off. And I remember walking all around the house, shutting the windows, shutting it all off. And it never got physical, but I absolutely bellowed in his face about all everything he'd done in my life that had screwed everything up for everybody, how he'd messed it all up. I just let him have it. And then when we had this conversation with Mr. P, the shrink,
yeah,
he said that conversation there was one of the most important things you ever did.
Yeah,
you got that out.
Yeah,
and it was funny because doing our friends in the north, I was playing a northeastern businessman, and there was an actress from the northeast who was playing a southern. And we were sitting in a caravan having a conversation in the week leading up to this bank holiday weekend where the whole confrontation with her father. So she's having to speak with a southern accent when she's from the northeast, and I was speaking with a northeastern accent being from the south, and we were comparing notes on life. Anyway, we're back in there on the Monday, and I said to her about what had gone on between me and my father, you know, and she said, well, she said, I had a relationship like that with my mother, and at least you didn't do what I did, which was stand at her graveside as her coffin was going down, screaming at her that I just wanted to let her know how much I hated her.
Blimey.
And you got it right. So at least you got to say it to his face.
Yeah. Well, it was good. That dreadful word, closure.
Closure. You got it.
You know.
That's it. He said, you did it. You said it. You said it all.
But, you know, so Mr. P was, that was really worth so much.
Yeah, was it? A life changer.
You know, and the fact was that you respected him.
Yeah. Oh, he had to be somebody I respected. This, you know, the real paternal character, somebody who would stand no nonsense.
Yeah.
He wasn't there to talk nonsense.
Yeah.
This was, you know, this is real.
It set you free.
Completely.
You know, that
completely. I walked away. At the end of it, I went in there because the job came to an end, right? So my life was going to be back to being a working actor, which could have been going anywhere, anytime, could be gone tomorrow. So no chance. And I said, well, look, you know, and also the money of it, I was, you know, paying like 5 sessions a week. It's like, could you think we can cut it down to, you know, like 1 a week? And he looked at me and he said, I don't know about that. I'm not really interested in that so much. I said, well, what about if I did 2 days a week? Okay, yeah, let's give it a try. So I went back the next week and I did the 1 day, and then I went back the second time and I said to him, I think it's time for me to go. You know, I didn't come along because I wanted to have a shrink that I go to. I came along because I wanted you to help me, and I'm ready to go. And he was sitting at his desk and he put his hand out and we shook hands and he said, go on, off you go.
Very nice.
And that was it. It was like a dad saying goodbye to his boy.
I mean, I think it takes quite a lot of courage to do that, to go through those things, because you can learn things that you don't want to learn here about yourself, and you're going, but actually, you know, the old saying, the truth will set you free.
But you know what? When you say that, Jeremy, I don't think I did find out things that I didn't like about myself. And he was certainly, if you were going to find out about yourself, you were going to be with him, because he wanted everything out of you.
Right,
you know?
Right.
There was no messing around with him. You couldn't flannel him. So I don't think I found out anything. I found out why I was the way I was.
Yes.
Why I'd been the way I'd been. I understood how traumatic it had been from, you know, starting off in the womb in a war and coming all the way through. I think that's, you know, he let me explain to myself what I knew, and he helped me translate and understand what I was saying in terms of the other side of that business, which is understanding what's going on in your mind as a result of what you've gone through.
Yes. It's fantastic you did that.
Yeah, very lucky to be able to do that, because just imagine if everybody that's going through all sorts of traumas all over the world was able to go along and make, you know, have that available to them, you know. It's such a gift to be able to afford to pay for that.
It is. And I mean, but the most important thing is to have somebody to talk to, and you know, you grade that up in terms of whatever. But have somebody, and always the best is to have somebody who's a stranger.
Yeah.
Who doesn't know you, and who doesn't know your world, and not interested in Larry Lamb.
No, not interested.
You know, and I think that's, you know, that's really important. Well, we're on the home straight now, and I just want to talk about two or three tiny things that I think seems appropriate to say this, that maybe again, you know, I'm looking back here, but there was a reconciliation with your mum.
Yeah, oh yeah. And that's the funny thing. I finish up, you know, I had a nice relationship with my mum. I'd, you know, emotionally it was killed because she'd had to leave me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw my mum regularly, and I took my boy and then my daughters to see my mum. But emotionally, you know, I'd mourned the loss of my mum.
Yeah.
She was gone.
Yeah.
Emotionally, we weren't connected at all.
But it never came back. That's interesting. So was it like a friendship?
It was like, you know, she was my mum. It was more, I suppose, really, I was more interested in letting her have the chance to be granny to my kids.
Yeah. Okay.
So I could let her have that. But she'd lost me.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, anyway, you know, but it's, there are certain circles that were squared, and
yeah,
that's one of them.
Very definitely.
You know, just bringing this back to the surface. I mean, you know, one of the things I think is great about you is that you are diverse, I think the expression is. That's probably the wrong word, actually. But I mean, what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is, you know, I think you do have a real range.
You do, but you've got to, you know, that's it. You've got to. I've just been so lucky. And people say to me, don't you want to do this? I don't want to do it. Honestly, I've had such an amazing career. I've played such a range of people in every country around the world, everywhere.
It's amazing.
You know?
Amazing.
I know. And that was all I wanted to do, really. I just wanted to travel.
Yeah.
I just wanted to travel. I wanted to go and see the world, and I've seen the world. French was this basis, and then I'd done German at night school. But if you've got French and you can speak it to a reasonable level, it's not difficult to pick up Spanish and Italian.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Which I did.
Latin. Yeah, amazing. Look, we always do this bit at this bit in the thing, and I know you don't want to do it, but I'm going to tell you. We also have this thing where we say, you know, what are your life jackets? What are
life
things,
jackets, yeah.
What are the things that keep you going, you know, or that you go, yeah, that book.
Books are such a big part of my life, but so much of what I read is non-fiction.
Right, that's okay.
You know, I'm a real history nut. And, like, I always think if I was, you know, asked what if I wanted the book that I will go back to all the time. Well, it's a trilogy. It's a trilogy on the history, the whole story of the American Civil War, which really fascinates me, by this guy called Shelby Foote.
Oh, yes.
He was an old Mississippian author of historical novels and a historian himself.
So I know that you are a serious swimmer. Bloody hell.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not as much the swimming.
It's more.
It's turned out to be, it's kind of getting in the water and just swimming for a while, you know, is something that I love. And what I've learned over the last 3 years and working around and going, like, so I've always got my swimming costume with me, and wherever I go I swim, but I've started to swim all year round.
Right.
And so that's been a life changer, because it's done me the world of good, getting in cold water. This morning I was in the ponds at Highgate, you know, because I'm at home and I can go there. And, you know, the water was 1 degree. And 3 years ago, before I started to do this, there was no way I could have done it.
Right.
And people say, I couldn't do it. Well, you can't if you think you're going to go down into a swimming pool in the middle of November, right? You're not going to do it, right? Because the shock will maybe kill you. But if you start in August and you just keep going every day, your body adapts to the temperature. And you'll get to a point. I remember it was the first year I did it, and I thought, you know what? I've got to put something on my feet because my feet, my extremities are really the problem. My head primarily, the first thing. Head, fingers, toes.
Right.
And so in the end, you think, right, I'm going to get a little hat, I'm going to get little gloves. And like my body is just fine with it, whatever it is. Yeah. And when I got in this morning at 1 degree, it was no different to the, you know, the week before last when it was 6 degrees.
No, but you've said it.
You've done it.
It's getting used to it and over a period of time.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay, poetry, please.
Poetry.
If you had to go, oh, that's all I've got, that volume, that...
What, a volume of it?
Well, who would it be?
Well, I mean, the thing is, the way I entertain myself is my whole thing is I'm writing poetry now and I'm getting ready to publish and if I really, you know, there's loads of other poems.
You can
talk of gin and beer when you're quartered safe out here and you're sent to penny fights and all to shot it. But when it comes to slaughter, you'll do your work on water and you'll learn to lick the boots of him that's got it. Now, in India's sunny clime, where I used to spend my time, a servant of Her Majesty the Queen, of all that local crew, the finest man I knew was our regimental bisti, Gunga Din. The uniform he wore was nothing much before and rather less than half of that behind, for a piece of twisted rag and a goatskin water bag was all the field equipment he could find. And that's the story of Gunga Din. And that's another poem that I learned from my father when I was a little boy.
When I asked you whether you had a film that you quite liked, you said that you quite liked a film called Zulu.
Yeah. I was intrigued because I knew Michael Caine was a working class actor, but there he was, playing a posh boy. Well, he'd had a stroke of luck because Stanley Baker, working class, I think Stanley Baker was a working class Welshman.
Yeah.
He was certainly a full-on Welshman.
Yeah.
But Stanley Baker had gone, you know, had a very successful career, and Stanley Baker was casting this film that he was producing, Zulu. And he was the one that gave another working class bloke the chance to play posh.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that for me, that was like, wow.
If you had to say what was your favourite performance, favourite role, favourite TV series, let's stick to that for the moment, what would it be?
My favourite TV series, it's always about the character.
Yeah.
You know, if I had to choose between playing the character that I played, that a lot of people know me for in EastEnders, and playing the character that I played in Gavin and Stacey, that character there in Gavin and Stacey is probably the closest I've got to playing somebody like me. Archie Mitchell in EastEnders, that's something generated by, you know, history of my father, my uncle, together with the history of the man that wrote the series, right? That's a character. Well, I wouldn't want to find myself around a place with him too much, whereas old Mick Shipman in Gavin and Stacey is a really nice guy. However, in the theatre, you know, playing a character like Claudius, playing a character like Victor in the play The Price my brain's going with me today, right? Arthur Miller.
Yes.
I think probably those two characters, both opposing characters in terms of who they were and the type they were, but playing Claudius and playing Victor in The Price are probably the ones that I've felt. Oh, there's another one as well, playing the lawyer in Inherit the Wind.
Who
was based on the character, the real-life lawyer, Clarence Darrow.
Yes.
So those three roles in the theatre, I think they're the roles that I've enjoyed playing and being those characters, because that's the thing. When you play something night after night after night and you've worked on it and you become it for that time you're doing it every day, you know, and you're doing 8 shows a week and you become it and it becomes you. Those are the things that really go with you. because when you're doing a part on a film or on a TV, you tear it all to pieces.
Yes.
And then you have to put it back, or they put it all back together in the editing suite afterwards, right? That they put it, or they bring it all, so you know what you felt like in this bit and that bit and that bit and that bit, but you do it all over the, you know, maybe 6 weeks or so. It's slightly different to go, you know, you play this thing, you're in a play and you're out there for 3 hours every night, 8 shows.
Blimey.
You certainly, that becomes you and you become it.
Yeah, amazing. Larry, you are a top rocker of all time.
I'm so pleased you've said that.
I want to say that. You've been really generous and fantastic. We've covered a hell of a lot of ground, but that's good. And I'm going to think, you know, I think your house in Normandy, your lake, your poetry, your swimming in the cold water. It's absolutely so, I mean, I just can't thank you enough. Really, really brilliant. Larry Lamb, what a top rocker of all time. He's here and he's going to come back another time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Brilliant. Wow, that was a great episode. Thank you for listening to How to Stay Sane in an Insane World. I'm Jeremy Thomas, your host with the most. Should you like to get in touch with me and make some suggestions, pledges of huge amounts of money, or just any questions you've got, try Jeremy at howtostaysane.co.uk. Just try that and you'll get through to me and all people will be replied. We've got lots of stuff coming up that's quite interesting, not just guests talking about their own situations, but also some quite interesting what is this, what is that type stuff. And we love doing it. We're not a regular conventional podcast, but, you know, with your support, we will carry on and be as groovy as possible. Thanks again for listening. Tip top and tidy. Bye.